What do you see as the primary purpose of a close examination of what really happened on 9/11? And is it enough to expose the fact that the government lied rather than to reconcile different different theories about how it happened and who did it?
Well, this goes to the heart of what my editorial policy has been as the publisher of a newsletter. By training, I am not an ideologue, so I'm not trying to report from any standpoint of having to justify any philosophical framework. I was a detective by training. I'm a journalist by training. The absolute standard that I have used for post 9/11 reporting is that I take official documented sources, whether it be the congressional record, mainstream media reports that people tend to accept, ABC, BBC, Wall Street Journal, Ad Infinitum, New York Times. I take documented evidence only that mainstream people don't challenge, and I assemble that and I analyze it in a way that makes it very clear that the government is lying. In other words, very clear example, the government says we had no knowledge of the attacks. I have since proven that there was massive insider trading on the stock market involving put options, and clearly established that the intelligence agencies monitor those trades, knew they were taking place, and we know in the case of United Airlines that the trades were placed through a firm that was once run by a man who is now the executive director of the Central Intelligence Agency. I've produced government records showing that the National Security Agency had broken all of Osama bin Laden's secure communications in January of 2001. I've also produced evidence from U.S. attorneys in financial cases where they admit that they had gotten into the terrorist banking system so they knew how the money was flowing. Given all of that uncontested evidence, you have to ask the government, why haven't you told us who placed the insider trades in advance of the attacks? What are the connections to CIA? And we know that you were watching those, so how come you didn't know? That's a very safe way to report what's going on, that's safe from any kind of speculation. I won't speculate, and that's why my reporting is bulletproof. And on the other hand, that's why you see guys like Solomon and Korn refuse to debate me on the issue of my reporting. They can't touch the facts because they can't hurt those.
Also, a longtime activist attorney here in Portland has said he believes that due to the length and the complexity of the Patriot Act, it's unlikely the Patriot Act was written after September 11th, at least not in its entirety. Have you heard anything about the Patriot Act being written before September 11th, or do you have any views?
Well, I know that I do know from sources on Capitol Hill who spoke to me off the record that, yes, portions of the act were definitely written before, portions having to do with the money laundering. And some of the work done on the civil liberties and cooperation between intelligence community and local law enforcement, which had been, there'd been a wall there before. I do know Congressman Ron Paul was definitely on the record as saying that he was not allowed to read the act before he was asked to vote on it. Many members of Congress, most of them never even saw the Patriot Act, yet they were herded into the House chamber and compelled to vote, and basically told by party leadership how to vote.
Do you see the desire to shape domestic policy as a significant incentive in any decision, or a significant incentive for the government to be complicit in something like 9/11?
To shape domestic policy? By that, do you mean to control public opinion?
To control public opinion and to pass things like the Patriot Act and the legislation that we're seeing right now at basically every level.
Yeah, I mean, we have in this book which I reported on and brought a lot of people's attention to, The Grand Chessboard by Zbigniew Brzezinski, written in 1997. He talks clearly about how unless there is a directly perceived external threat, unless the public sense of well-being is jeopardized, they will not be malleable, they will not be supportive of those programs, those activities which the government deems essential for the protection of the economic interests, i.e. Wall Street, the major banks, the oil companies. So yes, I mean, does the government scare people to make them, yes, it's called wag the dog, and it happens all the time.
How big of an impetus, or how big of a motivator, in terms of comparing it to oil and drugs, would you say their desire to control at least the U.S. populace and dissent within the U.S.
You mean Are you asking, are oil and drugs the prime reasons why they go to these lengths?
I'm asking if the going to these lengths is one of the primary motivators, as well as drugs and oil.
Well, oil and drugs, there's an old saying that God equals gold, oil, and drugs, mm-hmm. or guns, oil, and drugs.
Right.
Those are the economic ingredients that provide economic control for this new globalized world that we live in, that's run basically out of Wall Street and the major banks. It's very funny that the American people don't ask some obvious questions. In 1972, when Richard Nixon started the war on drugs, the federal budget allocation was $101 million. As we entered fiscal year 2001, the federal budget allocation was $20 billion for the war on drugs. Yet there are more drugs in the country today. They're less expensive, and they're of better quality than they were in 1972.
I guess my question is, and this is based on simply my own thoughts, to me it seems as if the industry around the drug war might even be more lucrative than the drugs, like the prison industry. And
yeah.
And then I guess I'm thinking in terms as well, are we going to see third world type slave labor in the United States within within my lifetime?
Well, okay, that was two questions. There's two money-making angles, and the powers that be, and my colleague Catherine Austin Fitz is an absolute genius with this. She has analyzed this. She's a former Wall Street investment banker, former Assistant Secretary of Housing. There's the money that's spent on law enforcement, which creates its own industry, which, you know, all its own empires, the law enforcement, the people that sell the equipment, so on and so forth. Then there is the prison complex that rises up, but that's another $30 billion a year, you know, to house. And we know that we've put a million people in prison in the last 10 years. 60-70% are nonviolent drug offenders. Some of them are doing that kind of slave labor now. What's even more insidious about that is that you have two corporations, Wackenhutten Corrections Corporation of America, that house some 30-40% of all inmates in this country. They are privately, they're privately owned corporations that trade their stock on Wall Street based upon how many human beings are in prison beds. Their net profits are derived by the number of human beings in prison. We know that post-September 11th, again, this is a story that I broke in From the Wilderness, following up on a New York Post story, is that the stocks of these two companies went up 200% in just 3 weeks after the attacks of September the 11th. We're working on a follow-up story now. I certainly think that if the criminal activities of the government become more egregious, and I've taken the position that the Bush administration is out of the closet as a criminal regime, they can't turn back. They have to now go forward to impose a full dictatorship if they want to keep their hold on power, that we will see signs of domestic unrest. We will see people beginning to speak out. I think Cynthia McKinney was just the first foot through the door on the Hill, certainly. And then we will see some very repressive moves by the government. And I think we have to expect that.
Soon after 9/11, there were two planes that went down. You speak about, I believe, the first one in one of your newsletter articles, I believe, the one that went down on October 4th while flying from Israel to mm-hmm. Novosibirsk.
Novosibirsk, yeah.
There are claims that it was shot down mistakenly by an errant Ukrainian missile, but there are also claims that the Ukraine denied their missiles could reach that location.
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear that claim, and what do you make of that?
Well, we've reported on that. We've done a story in From the Wilderness that now this number increases. I mean, from the last time I checked, there may be a bigger number, but there are as many as 15 world-class microbiologists who have died under very mysterious circumstances. Since September the 11th, the major one starting on November the 28th, again, I'm using open press sources, there were four, we don't know the exact number, microbiologists. Novosibirsk is the scientific capital of Russia, and it's well known as the center of scientific research. And so this was a Air Sibir chartered airliner, or commercial airliner, was shot down. We don't know how many were on it. But those four are just four of as many as 15. We have Don Wiley of Harvard. That's a totally mysterious event. Parks a car in the middle of a bridge, stands next to a rail, has a seizure at the moment that a semi-truck comes along, bounces him up in the air, and a gust of wind blows him off the edge of the bridge. That's the official story. We have guys beaten to death with baseball bats. The autopsies show no signs of trauma. All of them have in common now, as many as 15, and this has been continuing at a very alarming rate, is research in DNA sequencing, virology, communicable diseases, germ warfare, or treatment. So there's something very suspicious going on, and I've had one of my staff writers place 50 calls to the American Association of Microbiologists asking for comment, and they will not comment. When you have 15 world-class mic, this is a small community we're talking about. Something is clearly wrong here.
I was going to ask what the normal death rate was for a microbiologist.
I don't think I have to have the information to answer the normal death rate to tell you that what's going on here is not normal.
Yeah. And I believe in the document that I read by you, there were five microbiologists on that plane.
Somewhere between 4 and 5. We don't know how many. That passenger list has never been released. There were reports from the region saying that as many as 4 microbiologists were on the Air Sibir flight. 2 were killed in a plane crash in Israel. We had Don Wiley, Vladimir Pasechnik in England, who had defected from Russia, Benito Kay in Miami. We had Schwartz in Virginia, who was hacked to death in his farmhouse. And then a guy named Nguyen in Australia who had just perfected a new strain of mousepox and smallpox that was immune to smallpox vaccines, and he suffocated on some strange gas in his research chamber. I mean, very bizarre events.
Do you have any views or guesses as to what is going on here? Do you see it as part of a cover-up, or could it be the work of organizations actually trying to circumvent the ends of the people backing the research, or could it be both?
Who knows? I mean, these are great questions, all of which would require me to speculate to answer. So all I know is that something is extremely suspicious, and the common thread is the DNA sequencing, the communicable disease research. There is some link that we have not yet identified that makes these people either a threat to whoever might be preparing to do a very serious germ warfare attack, or might be potential detectives who could identify or who could produce a cure. We don't know yet. We do know that this research has progressed to the point where they can create gene-specific disease agents that will attack only people who have certain genes.
Then on November 12th, the fairly ironic crash in Queens, New York, of American Airlines Flight 587. Mm-hmm. It seemed awfully coincidental. The official story, I believe, was that the tail fell off mm-hmm. the plane. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I have lots of thoughts on that, lots of suspicions, lots of questions. Again, the position I've taken as a journalist is that I have experience as a journalist. I wrote my first piece for the Los Angeles Times in 1985. So. And these are what we call journalistic suicide missions. You can have great suspicion, you can go in and find all kinds of anomalies, but you cannot produce a concrete answer, and you still wind up leaving people able to believe one side, the other, or nothing at all. So for me, it's not productive to go in there. Does that look really stupidly suspicious to me? Yeah, it really does. So does the Pentagon crash. I've watched all the films. I have yet to see a 757 in any of the pictures hitting the Pentagon. But then I have to answer the question, well, if that wasn't a 757, where'd the airplane go? This is stuff you have to be careful with as a journalist.
There are also stories that there was a shadow plane. There are some witness accounts that there was a plane flying above the plane that flew into the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of that?
Again, but I can't prove it. I can't nail it down. That's like questions about, did someone place explosives in the buildings to make them collapse straight down? Were the planes possibly remote controlled? The answer is could be, I don't know, I haven't taken a position, I can't prove it. What I can prove is that the government is lying, and that's my job. The government is lying. The government is lying.
There are people that are speculating that the the collapse of the WTC towers as we saw it could not have happened without other incendiary devices within the buildings, that the jet fuel could not melt the steel mm-hmm. as it did, that there would have been larger pieces of the buildings left or phones or something if there were not additional bombs or other devices in the building. Based on your experience as an ex-cop and someone who has some knowledge of covert operations, how would you respond to that?
Well, again, that's one of those suicide missions as a journalist. I've seen compelling evidence that the jet fuel could have been superheated in the flues of the central elevator shafts to melt. Again, I'm not a scientist, I don't know. That's possible. Although, on the other hand, thinking logically as someone who has studied covert operations, the amount of explosives necessary to have achieved that kind of a controlled demolition, to put those on many, many floors of the building, would have required levels of secrecy and penetration. You would have risked compromising, smuggling hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds of plastic explosive, putting them in the right place, and that to me is a very risky operation in that building that's always busy. So that's something that I have to stay away from, because there's just no there. There's no out. There's no way to come to a definitive conclusion absent somebody coming forth and saying, you know, here's what happened and here's what I did. Of course, we know the evidence has been destroyed pretty rapidly, and I know that New York City fire experts were very upset that all the evidence was destroyed at WTC so quickly, but I can't draw a conclusion on that question.
Back very briefly to the microbiologist. What is PROMIS, and what does it have to do with them?
Okay. PROMIS has to do with more than just microbiologists. It was originally a program called Prosecutor's Management Information System, developed in the late 70s by Bill Hamilton at Inslaw, who I know. I've been to his offices, I've interviewed him many times. It was originally designed to be a software program that would take data from programs in any number of programming languages. In those days it was COBOL, and I don't know what they called it. The U.S. Attorney's offices had 17 different systems on, you know, like 8 or 9 different languages. PROMIS was originally designed to be a software that could be installed in all of those operations that would integrate the information from all these diverse languages and make it readable into one database. It was subsequently mated with artificial intelligence to begin to perform reasoning, simple reasoning tasks. It was stolen in the early 80s by Ed Meese, Earl Bryan, part of the Reagan administration, and intelligence agencies. Several different strains, if you will, of PROMIS developed. One was developed by the Israelis, one by CIA, etc. But they were incorporated with a back door that allowed intelligence agencies to go into somebody's database while they weren't aware of it and extract data, manipulate data, and to find out what everybody was doing. PROMIS became very useful in that it could integrate, let's say in terrorist cases, if you had a bunch of terrorist suspects, you could incorporate their telephone usage, their water usage, their power usage, their grocery shopping bills off their credit cards, and you would know, for example, that if the power at terrorist Z's house was off for 3 days, and the power at terrorist Y's house had doubled, that he doubled his grocery purchases, then maybe terrorist Z had gone to visit terrorist Y, and you wouldn't even need to conduct a surveillance. That's how powerful the software is. It's been applied, it's been enhanced many times. It's been stolen and modified. I was visited by members of the RCMP National Security Staff in the August of 2000 who were in the U.S. I was just one of many people that came to visit, and I still have their cards, and I pulled these cards out recently on a one-hour special in Canada where I was debating the former Canadian Solicitor General, Ron Atkey, on September the 11th. And I reached in and I said, and I pulled out these two cards from Canadian RCMP, National Security Staff. There they are, right there. And they admitted to me that Canada's RCMP's version of PROMIS software, which they admit was used, among other things, to track stock trades in real time, but used for scientific research, had probably been compromised. And they were uncertain as to who had compromised the software. And that was the investigation, whether it was CIA or CSIS, that's other intelligence service in Canada. And that software is everywhere. And Israel's had a hand in it. We know since September 11th that Osama bin Laden is reported to have the software. It was a great story that actually Fox News broke. I'm sure somebody in the progressive movement will call me a right wing because I quoted something from Fox News, but that's all right. It was a good story. And I followed up and got admissions from the FBI, who had denied for 18 years that they ever had the software. And when I called them, they said, we've stopped using it now, which means that they had it. So promise is very powerful. It doesn't need to be applied necessarily to scientific. It's very widely used in the financial community worldwide. Picture promise having the ability to integrate the data from a bank in Portland to a bank in Los Angeles to a bank in New York to Bank of America, you know, wherever, so that you can use your ATM card to withdraw cash. Promise works the same way. Now, a bank has an incentive to buy the software because it will enable the bank to interface with all the other banks, get more transactions and more fees. So when you sell it to the bank, you don't tell them it has the back door in it. But then you get to read all the banking transactions. And that's how the U.S. intelligence community, Department of Justice, FBI, and CIA, tracks money movement all over the world. That's how they penetrate the financial terrorist networks. Promise is extremely powerful.
Oh, has anyone claimed the $250,000 made from the just prior to September 11th put options?
It's $2.5 million.
Oh, I'm sorry, I got that wrong. $2.5 million.
$2.5 million. That was just one particular set of trades. To my knowledge, no. The U.S. government has gone absolutely stone cold silent on all the insider trading around September the 11th. The last time I had somebody call Securities and Exchange Commission, these are the only people who can find out who made the trades. I can't. Trading records, brokers, stock trades, they're as protected as medical records. So a journalist can't go find out who made a particular trade. It's against the law. The only people who are able to find out who purchased stock are the SEC, Department of Justice, U.S. Treasury, and Congress. And nobody's saying a word. The SEC has said, we will neither confirm nor deny the existence of any investigation. And yet I know, because these records, the fact of the trades was released through the Israeli Institute for Counterterrorism in Herzliya, Israel. That's how I broke the story. I got the records from them. Not saying who made the trades, but that they were made. That's proof that the intelligence agencies track the stock trades, but the government can't go there because I've directly linked the trades to the CIA already.
What do you think about stock trades being as private as medical records?
Well, that's just the law. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily want someone to know to whom I was writing checks. It's none of their damn business.
Right.
You know, and there are also good arguments to prevent insider trading to find out who's making what purchases of stock. If anybody could find out, of course, you would have everybody spying on everybody. And well, of course, the market's totally rigged now anyway, is my belief. But, you know, so there's very good arguments for privacy there. However, the government has clearly failed, totally failed at its responsibility. And God bless Cynthia McKinney for speaking out about this, to tell us who made those trades, because that's proof that somebody knew the attacks were coming.
And have you heard of Nisara? I saw this briefly.
Bogus. Doesn't exist. It's fake.
Who do you think is behind this post? They're almost unintelligible.
Yeah, it's, you know, I started getting emails on that. I was in Washington. I said, look, there's no such thing as Nisara. These white knight idiots. And, you know, every bill, anytime, this is a great piece of training for your listeners, okay? There's also the Bill 602P about the Internet email tax, which is total garbage. I've known that for years. Anytime anybody in this country wants to know whether there is or is not a piece of legislation that's being discussed anywhere, you go on the web, http://thomas.loc.gov. That is the master web clearinghouse for any piece of legislation from the moment in time when it's introduced as a bill by a member of the House or the Senate. It tracks it through committees. It tells you whether the bill is real or not, if it passed, who passed it, what the amendments were. That I use to check every rumor. There is no such thing as Nisara.
What do you think is the most effective way to raise people's consciousness about what's behind this so-called war on terrorism?
Well, aside from proving that the government is lying, which has been very effective with me, actually, See, I prefer not to speak to the choir, although I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the choir and all of the incredible people all over the country who have supported me, some very dear friends who have risked a lot of criticism within the progressive movement or the left movement, or, you know, I actually have people who are conservative who read my newsletter. But my goal is to reach the middle America, the unconvinced, and I do that by following my particular formula, which is to demonstrate that the government is lying.
And what do you think about the direct democracy and representational reform movements that are currently gaining momentum, like Granny D? Mm-hmm. Have you been approached by any of those people?
I have been approached actually to endorse an amendment that's being proposed for the U.S. Constitution. And I find this stuff very, very interesting. It's very intriguing. I had to respond and say that I love the concept, but anything that tampers with the Constitution requires an enormous amount of study on my part. And I would hate to quickly endorse something, because you don't tamper with the Constitution lightly. Well, the Bush administration tampers with the Constitution all the time. I would not tamper with the Constitution lightly. So I have said I basically support the concept. I cannot come out and endorse because I can't take the time now to research as thoroughly as I need to. I'm in a total triage mode. We're in a state of emergency here, so I'm doing the journalist activist thing on a breaking news story basis.
Do you have any comments on Jim Moore's upcoming book, Big Oil, Big War?
Haven't seen it. But people have got to get that something called the Hubbert Curve and the fact that we are nearing the end of the age of oil. World oil production either has or will soon peak on a bell curve, never to be exceeded again. And the whole world is going to change. Oil is not just what fuels SUVs. It's plastics, 90% of all plastics. It's also the fertilizers and pesticides that allow food production to support a population of 6 billion people that will be 11 billion people soon, as oil production is going to decrease. We are on the edge of a major world event in human history with oil.
Do you have any idea how that event is going to affect us? Do you see a second American Revolution on the horizon, or is it going to be a world revolution, or
that? No, see, this is what I see the Bush administration doing now. This war is presented to us as a war that will not end in our lifetime, period. Why? Osama bin Laden is no longer important, says George Bush. Wait a minute. We thought that was the whole reason. Yet what we're seeing now is a series of sequential moves. We have seen first Afghanistan to secure now for the Unocal pipelines and the gas pipelines. We've seen Iraq is heavily on the plate, and the Bush administration is doing everything to maneuver the world to supporting that. We know that Colombia is next, and I've been writing about Colombia for 2 years. Hugo Chavez in Venezuela was just overthrown. Hugo Chavez denied U.S. military overflight across Venezuela for Plan Colombia. Now that there's a new government, U.S. military planes can fly directly over Venezuela from Puerto Rico to southern Colombia, as we will soon begin the assault on the FARC guerrillas, who happen to occupy lands that are rich in oil reserves. This is a sequential war to secure the last remaining oil reserves. The strategy of the United States government is to use the U.S. reserves last. We will take them from the rest of the world first. We'll drill in Anwar last, the Alaska National Wildlife and Animal Refuge. We'll use the last remaining U.S. oil reserves only after we have controlled the last oil reserves around the planet. And that's the game that's being played now, to control what happens as the world moves out of the age of oil. Parts of the world are going to be burning candles in 15 years because there is no electricity. Remember, most of the electricity comes from natural gas, not from dams.
Do you believe they have a plan for after the oil is completely gone?
That may tie into the microbiologist story, and I'm not prepared to take the full leap yet, but we are exploring, and I have an excellent writer from the wilderness, Dale Allen Pfeiffer, who is a geologist, a scientist, he's written 9 books, some novels as well, that indicates the possibility that the lunatics have decided the problem is not that there's too much or too little oil, the problem is there are too many people. And this may be the motivation for the creation of these horrible biowarfare agents and the deaths of these microbiologists.
What do you say to the leftist argument that focusing on this issue will only further divide people, or that no one will ever believe it, so why talk about it?
I say those are the same people who would live in a family where the father's raping the young daughter and they try to cover up what daddy's doing just so the family looks good.
I have to ask this just to be a smart aleck. Are you a government plant?
A government plant? You mean like a...
And how do we know?
You mean like a rhododendron or a bird of paradise? A government plant. Look, there's a great test that I use. Metaphorically, I can show you the scars on my back. You can go on my website, and you can read front page Herald Examiner stories. It's a dead paper in Los Angeles from 1981, showing that then I had been homeless for 2.5 years. I had been shot at. I had been bankrupt. The FBI was calling me crazy. LAPD was calling me crazy. I have a paper trail going back 20-some years. There are people who know me, who saw me homeless, carless, jobless, bankrupt, arrested for selling liquor to a minor when the only job I could get was at a 7-Eleven store, and I'm an honors graduate from UCLA. That's the kind of oppression I went through. You judge people by the scars on their back. You say, show me the wounds. It's like doubting Thomas with Christ. If you're a Christian, remember when he said, show me, I want to see the hole. All right. This is the way you judge who the government plants are, one of them, and who they are not. The other way is by their fruits you shall know them. What have they accomplished? How have they put the government on the spot? What kind of changes have they brought about? So the answer is no, but you don't have to believe me. You can go to my website and see the documentation that's been there.
Yeah. Well, my other question was, how do you know we're not a government plant? But you answered that.
I don't care.
Last question. A lot of people would love to make a difference, but don't know quite what to do. As your last words in this interview anyways, what are some of the methods to best get the word out and to start breaking through in terms of trying to make a difference and trying to change things?
Most progressives, in my opinion, and I have a lot of respect for them, and I don't want to lump them because we're seeing a clear split amongst progressives from those who are behaving healthily from those who are not. So I don't want to categorize them. But my belief is most people would willingly take a bullet, you know, and say, I'll die like somebody in Reds or a big drama, but they won't risk criticism. And that's kind of psychologically dumb to me. You got to be able to risk criticism. You got to go out and irritate people. You got to get out, talk to the people who don't want to hear. You got to keep putting the facts. Not Mike Rupert says, I'm irrelevant, not Noam Chomsky, not Norm Solomon, not, I love Howard Zinn, he's great. Don't put the names out there, put the facts out there and keep sticking them in people's face. The other answer is vote with your money. Stop giving money to Time Warner, AOL, CNN, NBC, the people that lie to you. Give it to indie media. Give it to From the Wilderness. Give it to Michelle Chosudowski, who has a great website in Canada. Give it to Jared Israel. Give it to Truth Out. You know, give it to the brave activists who are still struggling to liberate the Pacifica Radio Network. That struggle is far from over. You know, and there are still people trying to free Pacifica Radio from the grips of people who I believe, in some cases, are government operatives.
Thank you.
Thank you.